Hello everyone, this is Shreya.
Hi everyone, this is Sukanya.
And we are back with yet another episode of Intersectional Feminism Desi Style Season 3, brought to you by Feminism in India.
Throughout the course of this podcast, this season, we've been speaking about how gender is stereotyped in different work industries. When we speak about work, generally we imagine somebody working for somebody else. So there's an employer and then there's an employee. Now, if you think about an entrepreneur, it sounds very exciting because you don't have a boss, you're your own boss, but that also comes with a lot more responsibilities. You're responsible for generating revenue, you're responsible for maintaining your staff, you're responsible for ensuring that there's a good working. It's a complicated mix in itself. Now, into this mix, if you put a woman and if you put at the core of this business a platform that speaks about gender, then it becomes way, way more complicated. So what is it like to be an entrepreneur? And much more than that, what is it like to be a woman entrepreneur speaking about gender issues in this country? Is it profitable? Is it lonely? Is it scary? Is it exciting? We will find out today.
To talk to us about this and more, we have with us the dynamic Shelly Chopra. Shelly is a former business journalist, author, and an entrepreneur. She's the founder of She the People TV and is one of India's largest platforms that talks about gender and women's issues. As a journalist, she'd won the prestigious Ramnath Goenka Award in Business Journalism in 2012. She's also recently started a new venture that's a digital health clinic called Gayatri.com, which reimagines the standard of female care in India. We are so excited to have you with us, Shelly. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, great to be here with Feminism in India. Lovely to be on your podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome to the podcast. We will just delve into the conversation directly. So, Shelly, I wanted to start with asking you about your journey being an entrepreneur. As in, you had a full-fledged journalism career and you decided to give that up and start your own venture. And that too, a platform that speaks about gender, women and their issues. It's not something that was perhaps back then considered to be a quote-unquote mainstream or a profitable business model perhaps, but then you chose to move ahead with it. And you have at any point in your decision, in your journey, did you feel, you know, did you face pushbacks or did you feel like getting comments from your inner circle saying that considering the nature and venture of your initiative, did you feel like, oh, is this going to work out? Is it profitable? Is it, there's too much on my plate to push, back and forth? Like, did you ever feel, how is it? I just curious to know that.
So, you know, setting up a platform, particularly in a country like India, which has the largest population in the world now, is often something you ask yourself, that is it really just about garnering an audience? Because in India, for everything, there are large audience numbers. Or do you think that, you know, there is a huge or a potential market gap that you're fixing? For me, the viability of a business is important, but it's not what determines whether or not I enter the business, because there are enough areas around us today that deserve attention and immediate attention, but they may not scream like the instant opportunity that'll give you 10x in 60 days. So for me, starting up a platform for women back in 2015 was a tough one, because one, I was an established name in the world of television. Two, I was exploring something that people wanted to believe was a hobby. Third, I think it was very, and the reason they thought it was a hobby was because I was focusing on women. For most men and women back then, and even to a great extent now, women are a niche segment, right? And that was, it was blasphemy for me to think that 750 million women should be called niche in a country like ours. They shouldn't be called niche anywhere. And third, I think I was very clear that the world of digital would give us access and wings to a very large audience outside of India as well. So women essentially lacked a safe space to have important conversations, and more than conversations, they just lacked inspiration from one another. Sometimes when you sit in the ladies' compartment of the Delhi Metro, you know, the fascinating conversations that women are having with each other, they just remind you that complete strangers can make a connection in an instant. And I think many ways that's the genesis of the birth of She the People. Now, having lived that journey through 8 years, I feel that the platform not just has built itself on basic pillars of profitability and sustainability, But it's important to also recognize that we created the market and conversation and space for women. That to me is invaluable.
Right, Shelley, I think we can relate to that. Having been in similar fields, it does like to call issues of so many, like your majority of the minority that you call women as niche is like not done. As you talk about, you know, the market and financial literacy and economy, a lot of time these, you know, when it comes to entrepreneurship or financial literacy or, you know, operating within the market, it is sort of looked at or like, you know, quoted as being the man's domain. There's this idea, you know, that women do not know what to do with money, what they're going to do with their money. But as a successful entrepreneur yourself, have you faced this bias in the course of the last 8 years when it comes to, say, dealing with investors or funders? You know, have they looked at you or questioned you or sort of, you know, grilled you, if I might use the word, in a certain way because of your gender? And how have you navigated it?
So I think women, even today, in what seems to have been at least now a half a decade of conversations on gender issues, women constantly get bullied, questioned, and they have a very significant display of bias. I'll give you a subtle example. I was recently at a party, and when they asked me what I was doing and I explained to them, you know, the men in the room said, oh, now we need to set up our own men, the people, right? And why did they say that? Because they were trying to hint that, oh, you know what, we need our own space. And I reminded them, I said, the space has always been yours. We are having to carve out a space for women because that space is not equal enough, right? So we are talking about really intelligent men, very well educated, running important organizations and are in important positions. One would have thought that this country's population, both men and women, are becoming sharper and smarter about the need, and they would champion equality and equal access, but they don't. Now, have I personally faced bias? Many, many, many times. And so I feel that I've had the challenge of dealing with both investors, CEOs, advisors, everyone who are essentially looking at asking you questions that you don't deserve. I'll give you an example that why do you think your idea focused on women is an idea that deserves $3 million as an example. Okay, so the fact that one has to justify the need to set up something around women to certain men, I look at it in two ways. One, it's an opportunity for me to brainwash somebody who probably needs it and hasn't found a woman as smart as me to do it for him. Second, I feel that if that person is so jaded and is refusing to open his mind, then he's the person I need to leave behind, right? And therefore, I've been very fortunate that in the journey of the last 7 years, I've had Anand Mahindra take the first step for me, a man who decided to champion us, despite all the trolling that he gets from the Bucks because he supports women's issues at She the People. Second, I've had of late Nitin Kamath, who invested in Gayatri, of course, along with Kiran Shaw and many other men and women. Ajay Srinivasan, again, a man, invested in Gayatri. I think there's a shift. And I think sometimes one needs to drive that change through conversations and dialogue, and sometimes with a bit of a strictness and a sense of extra pride and haughtiness, we should do it. As women, we shouldn't be shy. So I've faced a lot of bias. I've faced the bias in editing rooms in the media world, where somebody turned around and said, hey, listen, don't think that you'll be the managing editor. And I turned around back in 2008 and said, I don't want to be managing editor. I said, I want my face on television every night. You keep the designation, I'll keep the television. So it's just really about how you navigate this conversation. And to a great extent, I think women are shy about taking these conversations head on. I think that's changed about me.
Right, Shelley, while you speak about taking conversations forward, you also spoke about how if you find a man who's so jaded, you feel like, yeah, this is an opportunity for me to speak. So given all of that, it also, for as women, we know this and we see this every day, it's a lot of extra work for us as well. to, first of all, convince people for things that don't, that shouldn't need convincing in the first place. So it's a lot of extra work. So what I want to ask you is, it's perhaps a little personal, but I just want to know what it feels like to be a woman in your shoes. When you try to do this, when you try to bring out women's stories and also ensure it's financially viable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, as an entrepreneur, does it ever feel lonely? I mean, given the cishet patriarchal, heteropatriarchal nature of our society and the trolling that you yourself mentioned about how that alienates perhaps investors, supporters, allies, and all of that. In the middle of all this, you're this woman who's trying to do this. So what is it like, your, you know, your inner world? Like, do you feel lonely? Where do you find strength from? Who do you fall back on? What is it like?
So that's a tough question, honestly, for two reasons. One is that it takes me a lot to talk about how I feel personally. And this is because I'm raised to believe that one should bottle up feelings, just like anyone, right? Perhaps our parents see the world as one that's always gunning for women in different small and big, complicated and oblique ways. And so you sort of become like this little walnut who's like, okay, you know what? I'm just not going to let anybody come around me beyond this point. So it does get harder as one looks at it, but I don't think that it changes in the journey in a way that, you know, when you're starting out, it's tougher. When you get a little more established, it's easier. It's just that the kind of things that you face changes. And I think many times they become more in your face at the early point and then a lot less in your face at the later stage. And it's not easy, you know. So I think just to kind of put that around, that one, I don't believe it's the job of women to explain to men. I made this my job by setting up a platform which wanted to prove to the world that women have a role that they are playing very well, which is being themselves and not just slotting themselves into other roles that they're expected to do. And therefore, I do take a chance to make sure that this person remembers that there was somebody who decided to woman-splain him, and sometimes people do need that. So I hear you when you say that, you know, it's very, there's a lot on our plate already. So absolutely. Second, I think that no longer should we accept somebody's ignorance statement, because ignorance is not a choice. You can't tell me you're not reading the newspapers. You can't tell me today that you aren't listening to women like Angela Merkel or Christine Lagarde or the current head of the IMF or many others, or Geeta Gopinath or any of these. To be so ignorant that you're going to listen to these people when they talk a great deal of numbers and then not kind of understand that they've reached there with equal sort of hard work and various ways, and the same idea can trickle down to your neighborhood, to your community hall in the resident welfare community, or within your house, is problematic, right? If a man is going to ask his wife to bring his shoes so he can tie the laces, and he's going to admire the woman who's leading IMF, I'm sorry, that guy's out of whack, right? So I think these are things that are important to be solved. I don't think that's, that's the job of every woman. But I do feel women should express themselves. And hopefully from that expression, some learning will be left behind for somebody who basically thought they could get away with things. So that's a definite one thing. And second, I would say that I am, I don't know if I should use the word I'm lucky, but I should say that I have had in my journey a lot of men who have heard me out and changed and encouraged me to push this effort forward. I should also add that I tend to find that in my inner circle, there are a lot of men who are doing a lot of their role that they should be, as one is expected. So I'm in that sense feeling that there is some change that's beginning to happen. And that's encouraging. And they've also been around to hear me out, as have women been around to hear me out. But it's not easy to share everything with everybody. So in that sense, I would say, like many other women, I'm quite a private person. I hold up a lot of stuff inside me, which can be damaging.
Right, Shelley, it's interesting you mentioned that, when we talk about, like, you know, if a man is acknowledging certain women, because they are at a position of power, but not doing the same within their own households, then it just, like, you know, it doesn't make sense. Talking about that, do you think, like, we all know there's data that proves that women's work is not taken seriously, or it's not considered work. We do not have enough data on women's work as is. We might have, like, some data on the work, say, a certain class of women are doing, but most of it, like, you know, unpaid labor is not counted as labor, or unorganized labor is not, there's not enough data. So do you think as a platform that is talking about women's issues, you know, platforms like yours, like FII, we are quickly labeled as soon as you say that, oh, you work for She the People, or you work for FII, you're labeled in this, put in this box. Oh, this is what you do. These are, you know, these are certain labels that go with you. So do you think in terms of awareness, we've come a long way. We now have a lot of platforms that are talking about women's issues. But do you think that awareness is also on the surface level and does not percolate within, and that bias just continues? Because I know I can speak for myself, Sukanya, and a lot of us who work in this sector, that this constantly trying to explain to people what you're doing and why you're doing it, it's just like, it just gets to your nerves sometimes. So do you think we have progressed when it comes to awareness there?
Yeah, so I think the answer is somewhere in the middle, right? I think what you said holds true, that in our world, when it comes to, you know, work, our work as women is not taken seriously enough. It's, you know, many times it's not even valued and calculated, especially in terms of the unpaid care that we do. There are a couple of things that I just want to say here is that one is that money makes people uncomfortable, right? Because money leads to power in the hands of women, which is why as more and more women try to become independent and speak their mind, people are like, oh, you know, this girl's very chalu. What do I do with her? You know, she's over smart. Who's going to marry her? Then you tend to hear these dialogues constantly around you. And the reason I brought up money is because actually, to a great extent, what is measurable is often what is acceptable. And that's why this entire conversation of where we are today on this, while we seem to take two steps forward and three steps behind sometimes, it seems that the change might come as long as we are able to push and get more and more control in our own hands for our own life. Now, can this be easy for every woman? The answer to that is no, because circumstantially, we have a lot of things going on. And so it would be naive for me to think that any woman who is able to just earn may be able to even spend or have control over that spend. But I think there is a starting point. And the starting point is just the awareness of why it is important for women to get their health checks done. Why is it important for them to have money? Why is it important for them to go out there and network amongst each other and also with men? Why it's important for them to raise their hand? Why it's important to them to ask a question, right? Women are shy of asking basic questions, and I think and apologetic. I think these things are changing, and I feel that the work that you guys are doing, what we are doing, is actually playing into the idea of what I call the sisterhood economy, that we are picking up things that don't seem to have a very direct economic element to it, because it seems like, how do I measure this? But to me, all of this that is unmeasurable is the biggest element of that economic value that we are seeking today. So definitely there's a transition, there's a shift. I was talking to somebody the other day, if I hear a prime minister in any country talk about sanitary napkins on their, you know, during their speeches, I have deep respect for them, especially if they're men. We've seen good examples set in by female leaders in many countries as well on what is acceptable. For a long time, I kept thinking that India was the one behind on the, you know, on the gender index. The answer to that is that it is very behind. But I think in terms of how women and their unconscious biases go, we are just equal to what's happening in America or Australia. I am horrified by the stories in the developed world of how women are treated. So I just don't, you know, I don't necessarily see hope on other shores. I do see that the Indian woman is getting feisty, and, you know, not just Indian women, I mean, women, people who identify themselves as female across India are getting feisty and are talking about their rights. And that's a very important conversation. I see that intersectionally as well, because we are seeing now, finally, we on our shelves, we have excellent writing by women from the Dalit community. even those who are trying to bring the dialogue on women forward, including in my book, there's a chapter on caste. The reason for this is very straightforward, right? We're a complicated country with complicated layers, and gender is not just about gender. It actually, I mean, inequality isn't just about gender, it's about many other things. So the conversation is important. It's begun. It's making people uncomfortable, and discomfort is always good.
Right. Speaking about discomfort, definitely conversations that upset or in any way question status quo is discomforting, and there's a lot of resistance and all of that. We've spoken about all of that. But what I'm also wanting to ask you is that when we talk about women entrepreneurs, we must also speak about marginalization, like you said, on the basis of caste, class, the urban-rural divide and everything. And feminist organizations have very often received the critique of gatekeeping. We discuss intersectionality, but practicing it is also key. And when you run an organization which speaks about gender, you know, broadly, bringing in these factors, making sure your team is inclusive, making sure your content is inclusive, and also making sure that it's financially viable in a space where there's so much resistance and so many people upset because we're speaking about all these different intersections, is quite difficult. So what are your thoughts on the same? How did you imagine She the People, and how did you imagine putting all these conversations together and also opening up space and opening up, you know, navigating these hostilities and in terms of finance as well?
I think this is a very important question, and it's a question that's on our table as people who are founders very often. So let's pick up on how do we structure She the People's hiring. Our hiring is extremely diverse. We are constantly encouraging our HR team to look for people who are from different regions other than the four metros. Secondly, they come from different religious backgrounds. They come from different caste backgrounds. They come from different gender backgrounds, right? Are we able to fix a seat for each one of these? No, we don't function like that. We encourage that process to be organic, but make extra effort looking for this so that we can get people in the right role and also have, you know, their intersectionality very much so, because we don't just want to fill a seat. We want that conversation to be reflected in the content, right? So our intent is across that value chain. Second, I think, is in terms of just the content itself. I have two views here, and in my own self announced way, I would add that sometimes part of my view is controversial. One is that it's very important to get women from different communities and castes to write their own journey and story. Absolutely. So we do invite women on a very regular basis to share their stories. Our teams editorially reach out to women from different backgrounds and communities and classes and castes to share their journey in their words. But as a journalism platform, one thing that's very clear to me is that if the story happens to be of somebody, let's say a Dalit woman's story, right? Does that mean that a non-Dalit person should not write and report it? Absolutely, she should write and she should report it. I have debated this internally, I've debated this externally. I do not believe that somebody who's a reporter or editor or an opinion writer should forget that their job is to collect the perspectives of different people and present the story to a reader. And therefore, it's really important to say that one should look at intersectionality in a way, how intersectional is the thinking of your team, right? So create a space where people can write their own journeys, but do not take away the space where reporters will report on others and not constantly be questioned, oh, if this story is not written by a person who is not from an X community, therefore they won't have that lens. Reporting and journalism is different from a field such as being, you know, MBA. Where at least you're not trained to look at these things. We in this world of content are trained, and that goes with you know, from the fact that I studied my journalism in Chennai, and that same ethos has been passed on to the team. A large number of our colleagues come from Asian College of Journalism, where intersectionality is a very significant part of our conversation. Okay, and reporting. So I think there has to be a mix of both. I'm not even saying there needs to be a balance. I'm saying there's going to be a mix of both. Is there somebody else? There's a lot of peer-to-peer checking in our team, which is also a very different way from, let's say, how we started. We used to always have very senior editors. But the reason we moved to peer-to-peer checking is because One, everybody who's in the peer network is able to understand where the other person's coming from in the same generational sense, and also the understanding of what our society wants today. So the conversation on intersectionality get far more fluid and interesting because somebody has got your back in case you're sounding like you're on an upper lens or a lower lens or the wrong lens or the, you know, what we call in television, the look room. If you're looking down on somebody or looking up on somebody. So I think these things are really important. The third thing is that we're talking much more about intersectionality than exercising it. Absolutely. It's fashionable to talk about it. Instagram is really, according to me, the hotbed of a lot of claims with very little work. Why? Because the number of people sitting there and talking about the communities and not even getting off their house to do anything about it is phenomenal, right? Now, do I think that those people are not doing an important role? I think they're doing a partly important role of at least raising awareness. But I also think in the long term, it's a shallow way of approaching things. So honestly, intersectionality is fashionable for many people other than those who are working on the ground.
Right. Shelly, coming to your newest venture, the Gayatri.com, it is a platform that is looking at care, healthcare through a gender lens. So I wanted to understand, A, what was the idea behind it? And B, like, you know, having now running two startups, two organizations, what are the advantages and challenges that come with it? And what would your advice be to others, like, who are running multiple startups, multiple entrepreneurial ventures?
So personally, I'll be honest, I don't see this as two startups. I have a single focus area in my journey, which is women. And I'm creating for them, you know, whatever they need solves for in their current life journey. So the birth of Gayatri as a concept actually came from She the People, because we spoke to so many women day in, day out, and asked them to DM us on Instagram what their needs were. And increasingly, we realized that health, women's health, especially explained by doctors, was one gaping area of you know, absence of information, absence of credibility. And we experimented with that over the last, say, 24 to 36 months, and realized that women really do have a challenge. I still remember, and I should credit you guys for that early survey you did about judgy gynecologists many, many years ago. And I never forget that. The reason for that is because I know that what it is to be judged by a gynecologist. Do you go to a doctor to get a lecture? We barely have the patience to take lectures from our moms. We don't need our doctor who we are paying to tell us about how much sex we should have, what should be our contraception, you know, what should be our baby plans, and whether or not we are, basically planning a life of marriage or not. None of these are. I think what is important is that we go to spaces that are very directly there with solutions. So when we started Gayatri.com, our plan was very clear. Offer a solution to a modern Indian woman who deserves to get an answer for her problem, not a lecture in return. So safe spaces, no bullshit, no drama. Ask whatever you want. The hashtag of the platform in its launch phase is called Khul Ke Poocho. Just ask whatever you want. And every doctor at the platform right now, every health expert, every nutritionist is basically not just trained, but we have a medical board that has doctors who have worked and continue to work in large organizations like Just Lok, Reliance, Tata Hospital, and others. It's backed by doctors because we're not pretending that you can come here and perhaps just get another Instagram quote and feel good about yourself and walk out. Therapists are all trained as well, and they understand this, and they've been practicing for many years. So the idea of creating this is really twofold. One, create a space where women can go for total care. Why do I say total care? Mental health for women is deeply hormonal. They just don't know that, right? Nutrition is deeply linked to your hormones, and the reflection of that in acne, hair fall, and other things, again, linked to the gynec situation you have. So when I say total care, it means not just nutrition, not just therapy, not just gynec, not just dermat, the total care, right? So that's number one. Number two is that clearly women need a space that says that, come here and solve for what you need. Right. And it's not like as if you already know. Where the problem that women have is, one, they don't know about their bodies. Secondly, they don't know what's going wrong. So if they don't know, how can they come there with a solution that, you know, with a situation that, oh, listen, what? I have this. right? Or I have that. I have PCOS or I have endometriosis. They don't know if they have it. And so the platform helps them ascertain whether they have it, rather than it being a fact that, listen, my friend has the same symptoms, I'm having the same problem, I'm going to take the same medicine. It doesn't work like that. So I think those two are fundamentally the challenges we're solving for women. And somebody again asked me, so why is this not a welfare program? I was like, no, women's health should be a profitable space and should be a space where people know that they have to pay for women's health. And we create ways in which the platform is so affordable. It's 40% cheaper than anything you can get off the market with the same quality of the doctors. Why? Because we know we want to change things ground up. At the same time, we don't want it to sound like this is that Sarkari place where you will go just because it's women's issues, meaning it should be free or whatever, you know, because then they relegate the idea of anything for women to something that is social work, which is partly the problem. And it goes back to the point I made about money. When women appear powerful, when platforms grow and start claiming their space, people are like, oh, this seems to be taking its, you know, place in the sun. To me, that is an important thing. I mean, that's the reason why both She the People and Gayatri are businesses.
Right. So we've come to the end of this conversation, sort of. So finally, I want to ask you, what is the one thing that you would tell young women and queer entrepreneurs? And like you said, that there are a lot of business. I mean, She the People has opened up a business model which has shown that there can be a robust and functioning, feasible, profitable business model, while you also speak about issues that are important, centering on gender and identity and health and everything. So what is the one thing that you would like to, you know, like tell younger people who might be venturing into these spaces as entrepreneurs and also who might be dealing with apprehensions to start their own ventures, considering the pushback they face? So if there was one thing that you would like to tell them, what would that be?
So, you know, there's a full chapter on this subject in my book, Sisterhood Economy, for a reason. Because we are scared of money. We're scared of talking about it. And we are very scared of the impression people will have if we talk about money. And so one of the things that pushes most people back in queer communities and among women when they're setting up something is like, how can I ask for money for this? That's the question on their head. And I think that's really where the genesis of the problem is. Everybody in the world should be able to put a value to the work we're doing, right? Just turn back time 10 years. I'm sure you and Japleen and everyone else has heard this. Oh, listen, but who pays for content? Why should people pay for content? Content should be free. People pay for the newspapers. Newspapers have survived despite the digital downturn. And so have the companies that wanted to be digital only. They have thrived as well. So the point here is that, you know, if you stand up and say, this is what I'm doing and I do charge for it, just give yourself the opportunity to let people pass if they are not willing to do this for you. Stick with people who are your champions. So just as a to-do list, I would say that this is just my list, right? So I don't want to kind of be the person giving gyan to anyone. But my first list is I basically told myself, go in to create an organization that'll be sustainable, which means you have to make money to run the org. Okay. Which means you have to think about either a corpus-driven business or you're driving a profitable venture. Take that call. Don't be shy, because everybody will make you feel guilty. Social impact, no money. Why should we pay you? This is your job. You were born to do this, right? So that's one. Second is that the advocacy that you're trying to bring forth, always go to people who are in decision-making positions. This is hard learned. Sometimes it's tough. But even then, even if you have to spend more time cultivating the right person, at least you're spending time in the right direction. Just don't go out there with somebody who is who may in the long run lead you there eventually. Be a lot more focused. Pick your battles clearly and figure out who's going to help you in that battle with whichever platform or company or organization that you're going towards. And number three, I think, is that We tend to do this less, and there's enough debate about why do we have to do it a certain way. But I think networking is very important. I'm really bad at it myself. And over the years, the older I grow, the less I want to network, really. The more I want to spend time listening to recitals and watch Bharatnatyam. But I think we need to network because we are in a world, particularly in India, billions of people. Now, in such a large country, somebody has to speak up and tell their journey in order to be heard. And that's why one point I made earlier that women and many other people don't ask questions. The reason I used to ask questions back in college is because I was very annoyed sitting in a room or a auditorium of 500 people and thinking that who's even noticing us here? Who cares? Who's studying? So I would raise my hand really high and stand up and spend the clearest part of my voice telling my name. I wanted the room to hear my name. And then I would ask my question. And it didn't matter to me how good a question that was. It was just that I wanted to make sure that people are attending to my existence in that room. Why did I have to do this? I was trained by my dad to remember that we are in a world where there are way too many people. And if you want to ask a question, then ask a question and make sure that you ask it loud enough for the whole world to know who's asking the question. And my final point here is number four, which I would say to all the young girls who are listening to this podcast, confidence is key. Invest in confidence. Don't necessarily invest in academics. All that will happen. Do make sure that you're able to communicate well and be confident because machines can't take that away from you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Shelley. It's time to wrap up this conversation, and thank you so much for speaking so intimately about what runs in your mind as an entrepreneur, as a journalist, as someone who runs a business which you were perhaps told would not fly, but here you are doing that, driving conversations and more, inspiring people and extending sisterhood, like your book suggests, and like you rightly said. Thank you so much for spending this time with us and speaking to us. It's been great talking to you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks. All the best to the FI team. We
Thank
love
you.
you.
That's all, everyone. We'll be back with yet another episode of Intersectional Feminism Desi Style Season 3. Stay tuned and stay safe.